outside chance that maybe Constantine is in some way referential to his life working with...
Oh, like he's having to... That's an interesting point.
Well, right. If I remember the chronology correctly, he worked on Constantine before he had more than probably a passing interest in the occult, didn't he?
Yes, yes. And that's... Oh, yeah. In our legends, in our issue of this story arc, issue 3 or 4, we do one on the legend of Alan Moore. And whether it's a self-imposed, self-created legend in and of itself, or, you know, and then there's outside legends, but he's claimed that on 3 different occasions that he has met John Constantine, the real-life John Constantine.
And that I think that in a way, that's almost like the Jerry Seinfeld's neighbor. Who may or may not genuinely exist.
Right.
Kramer. It's Tyler Durden.
It's Tyler Durden.
Oh, wow. So yeah, he's essentially met himself.
In the second meeting, John Constantine taught Alan Moore the secret words of magic. So that's how he learned magic, was from John Constantine. This is what he says. This is like I don't know if he's being Alan Moore or not being Alan Moore, you know? Like how much of a man is Alan Moore?
What we're describing, at least assuming his, and we can't do anything but assuming his claims to have had occult experiences are genuine, at least from his perspective, we're describing as something that's vaguely similar to shamanism, where the shaman, with or without the use of interesting chemicals, enters an altered state of consciousness.
Right.
Has this experience. Now, is the experience physically real the way, a Buick sedan is? No.
It could be like, you ever see altered states?
Damn. Intellectually real? Yeah.
I'm going to say this right now. I quit the show and bequeath it to Jefferson. Yeah. You and Jefferson now have a show. I'm going to go sit in the corner and cry because I can't do this.
Nobody puts Andy in the corner.
Andy puts Andy in the corner. That's. Well, do we want to get started?
I think we're already started.
I don't think we need to warm up this one now.
No, hell no. Dial it back.
Yeah, because Jefferson came in hot on this.
He did.
Yeah. We're going to go in media res.
He came in Top Gun. He's
like, yeah, like Gilead.
I think we just both give the show over to Jefferson because he's at present become both of us.
He really has, but he's like our final form. We've come together to form Jefferson. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hey Kids Comics. I'm doing this. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hey Kids Comics. You have found us in the middle of a conversation, and I'm going to leave a lot of that in. This is issue 133. We've begun this epic journey, this hero's journey into the mind of Alan Moore.
I think we sort of put our feet in the water with the creator spotlight.
Yes, we did. And that's where we realized there was enough material here to really take 5 issues of Hey Kids Comics and look at the man that has defined, I really feel like he has defined a storytelling era, at least for us and for thousands of other fans.
Oh, absolutely. I think that he redefined the medium.
Yes, and with us, joining us, and apparently our final form from, he's like the Bart Allen to Wally West and Barry Allen here. Yeah. He's the best of us, really.
I am the future.
And he may or may not be a future version of us.
If there was...
In the future, we get firestormed. We get firestormed into one entity. It's Jefferson. He's come back to the past to visit his friends in the past.
That is a verb that I'm going to use from now on when fusing two things together.
That's right. Especially if, like, you're going to make a cake or something, you can imagine the ingredients have been firestormed.
But we are joined by brilliant artist, comic book contributor. Contributor to a great many things in the area down here.
Thinking man. I want to think of that.
Yeah, a gentleman scholar.
Yes, he is certainly
a scholar.
That's true. Jefferson Harris joins us. Jefferson, thank you. It's been a long time coming. You're one of those people that anytime we have a more cerebral topic, I always think about you, and then for whatever reason, I'm a jerk and don't reach out to you because usually I don't want to put that on you. Like there's people out there that I will put a topic on. You know, I will be like,
he felt it below you.
Yeah, I did. I honestly did. but Alan Moore is definitely something that I feel like can a vessel to hold your vast wisdom. So we decided to, no,
this,
to
this
ask.
This is the crucible upon which.
It's true. So
never a bad time for the word crucible.
It's never.
I know. I've been waiting all week to say crucible.
This is our Jefferson. Every once in a while, we decide that we need a gauntlet. This is the gauntlet of this quarter. This fiscal quarter's gauntlet is right. Alan Moore. So Cole, do you have a fanciful title for this issue of Hey Kids Comics?
This is actually, and I forgot to bother looking this up, but. Because I wanted to actually act like I knew more than just remembering the name, and it had some vague Grecian formula to it.
I use that.
Yes, indeed. This was the Works and Days by which takes its title from the ancient poet Hesiod, from his 800 line didactic poem, apparently. The Works and Days. Which is every bit, I would point out, as exciting as you might imagine. Poet from a Greek writer around 700 BC might have been.
This is
really, Hesiod was one of the reasons it's been chronicled that they invented television.
He had a face for radio, Hesiod.
But Theogony kicks ass.
Damn you!
You know what I want to do? And I'm going to put this out there. This has nothing to do with Alan Moore. I want to do another Gods and Monsters show with Kelly and Jefferson. And I want us to quietly step away.
We show up for that one.
I want to quietly step away. I want to get them started and then just walk into the shadows and let them go. Just brom! Just be great. It would be Mount Olympus of a show.
Oh,
it would be... They'd just be moving.
It would be
pieces.
Mount Olympus crashing into Asgard,
it's,
crushing whatever realm Kumarbi was from.
Right, Mazda rises up, and so
that Earth Turtle thing.
The way we're doing this story arc for Alan Moore is we kind of got it broken down in its component parts. We're going to discuss. Alan Moore's comic book works in the first one. It was obvious that probably was a good starting place, sort of a literary biography, and then issue two. Hopefully Catherine will be here. I believe she will. And
I believe she will be on the next one.
And what are we discussing in issue two?
In issue two, we're literally going to be kind of jumping the pond, as it were. This is where we talk about the point where Alan Moore is coming of his own in America.
Okay. Okay.
Breaking free of sort of being, you know, the occasional eccentric who would buy a copy of Warrior magazine in the States. You know.
Right. Right.
Somebody was buying the damn thing.
When you happened to be at the one comic shop in the tri-state area that carried Warrior magazine.
Yeah. When you see the Axel Press button on the cover, and you wonder who's going to buy this crap. But
it was us. It was us. And then. Issue three, I believe we are delving into the legend of Alan Moore, the varied myriad legends that surround the man.
Anal Nathrak.
Right.
Wow.
The hill, the end.
You're speaking the words of the, was it the word of making, or what was that?
The charm of making. Yeah,
the charm of making. Yes. So tell me, Jefferson.
It's going to storm tonight anyway.
So Jefferson, tell me, what is the fire? What is the rock that burns?
Sulfur.
Of course. Very good.
Shit.
That's elementary alchemy, I'll point out. That's still.
Still alchemy nonetheless.
That's a good start.
Issue five, we are discussing his politics, his social and world views in issue four, I'm sorry. And then issue five, very pleased to have Hunter joining us to discuss Alan Moore in Hollywood, which is always a hot button topic.
Yeah.
Missed that one.
That's right. That's going to be a fantastic episode. So
Sunday,
Jefferson, again,
Sunday.
Thank you for gracing us with your presence on this. And I mean that. I'm not being facetious or histrionic. Thank you.
Yeah, it's strangely like listening to, like when I'm putting together each issue on the JCU site, and while I'm doing all the copy and getting all that, I'm listening to the show, and just listening to you by yourself is strangely like listening to both of us on the show.
It is. It is. Cole and I are going to step away, and you're just going to be talking, and
We'll have left, and we'll be in the corner crying.
So Alan Moore starts writing comics. Why? Let's discuss that. How does it happen? Like how does he get to a point where he's at least writing for Warrior or whatever? You know, there his past is well documented. And he's obviously not going to come on any show and discuss it. So we're very lucky to be able to have the internet in this day and age and do a little research into him.
Yeah, as before, like we talked about in a previous issue, you actually had to do things like own a lot of magazines.
Right, or go find them, or go to a library occasionally.
God forbid.
He, like any artist of his ilk, he was way too smart for his own good. Yeah. Started out
and working class in Britain,
right?
In mid 20th century, I think you can't ignore that.
Well, and what does that mean? You know, for somebody with an artist's soul, which he obviously
it used
had
to mean that your dad worked was a coal miner.
Yes,
and so did you.
And so did you, and so did
tungsten
his father.
Carbide drills. That was
exactly. I've been more gala luncheons than you had hot meals, lad.
Exactly right. But I think it's something you
Dear
see
God,
with...
Get out of my head, mister.
Oh, my God, I can't deal with two coals. I can't deal with my two coals tonight. I can't do it.
In Sorry, that time, in that place, you're seeing, as an artist, you start to see a rebellion against, certainly in the science fiction and fantasy genres, like Elric. You see a rebellion against heroes that came before that were kind of... You know, black and white.
Right.
The old-fashioned sort of Superman.
Right.
And I think that's the scene, really, that he was a part of.
Okay.
Very much so.
I agree. And so what he does is he gets bored, as most really intelligent people do when they're forced to
toil up under the yoke of, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He gets bored, and he basically fails out of school. Because it's not intellectually challenging for him in the way that he needs it to be. And again,
remember he's working class. They're not going to go out of their way to help him.
No, not at all.
That's true.
Not at all. So,
because in the words of Judge Smales, the world needs ditch diggers too.
There you go.
And so he essentially in the 60s creates his own outlet. He creates his own fanzine, which, in true Alan Moore fashion, is named Embryo, for reasons because Alan Moore.
That reminds me very much of back when Catherine and I were working for Diamond. You know, it was working with a lot of people like that. You were, you know, more intelligent than most people would have given them credit for.
Right.
Highly creative. And, you know, the working for Diamond packing comic books was the closest we're going to come to, you know, having a dream job.
Right.
And, you know, there was all this just, you know, wildfire of creativity on the line all the time, just stuff being spoken. And somebody said, well, why don't we put our money where our mouth is, as it were, and we published a little anthology comic that, given who it was who was the one behind this, putting this all up, it was called Blame. About the only thing I didn't really like about the thing was the fact that it was called Blame. But at the same time, I knew the guy, and it fit. It worked. It was very much spoke to who he was.
Right.
Not exactly conducive to people wanting to pick up a copy of the thing, but then again, you know, you had Hate?
Was one of
Flo's
the
book or something like that. So.
Like the little, like the Ashcan anthology type, so, yeah.
But, you know, that was very much what we were trying to do, is just sort of at least give that creativity some kind of an out before God created the internet and gave us all podcasts.
Gave everybody a mic. That's pretty much what happens.
Welcome to the future.
That's
there
right.
There you go.
You will listen to my thoughts. And if you, even if you don't, I'm going to pretend you do and be validated by my own idea of what you do.
That's why we are huge in Russia and Ukraine.
So I have a question for the panel. Like, so he creates his own fanzine. He eventually gets married, but then he starts working as an illustrator, as a cartoonist, essentially. And he starts writing, and he starts doing this under nom de guerre, under assumed names. Names like Kurt Vile, under Jill Del Rey, under My favorite, Translucia Baboon. Why write under an assumed name if you're Alan Moore? You know,
well, he wasn't Alan Moore yet.
But why not become Alan Moore? Obviously, at this point, the Alan Moore we know now, as Alan Moore, you know, has extreme narcissistic tendencies. Like you were saying, he definitely has delusions of shamanism or actual shamanism, depending.
Well,
on...
I wouldn't claim I don't believe he's actually taken. You know.
Yeah. No. But why start with do you think this is a period of self-discovery for him? Do you think that he hasn't yet fully realized?
It's certainly possible that it speaks highly of, I mean, you know, does the name Alan Moore jump off the page in the way, say, you know, some of the other names do, like, you know, Jill DeRay.
Anything that ends in baboon is obviously going
the baboon name is perhaps the most, and also, you know, you're speaking both to an audience and to a time when things England and elsewhere, things like punk rock were starting to become a thing.
You're talking about the early to mid 70s, so yes, yeah. we were
people were starting to think, hey, I got an idea what to do with these safety pins.
That's part and parcel of the scene going back of that sort of, you know, Pink Floyd sucks rebellion,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
era.
Right.
So I think that, you know, trying to have a persona that is beyond a rather, you know, the name Alan Moore might seem common as mud,
mundane, yeah.
But you know, these other nom de plumes are going to be a little more exciting.
Right. Right. And. Post that, I mean, he started, and under those names, he still contributed. He contributed to a...
That's why I write under Enzymitis Phalanges, because it's far more exciting name than Cole Houston.
I have so many names I write under. All you have to do is go back and listen to 133 issues of Hagen's
Comics.
That's
so true.
My favorite is Night Cream. That's my favorite that I write under.
And also, I have to say, your best work is under Night Cream, by the way.
It is. I worked up for a while as Lance Sanchez, Queen of Mexico. That was possibly my favorite. But then he starts working under these names. He starts working for, like, Doctor Who Weekly, 2000 AD. Let me say that again, 2000 AD.
Yeah, that was a time, there was actually, you know, 2000 AD sounds so futuristic, but there was a time when Harris Publications, who had, you know, in their catalog, Famous Monsters magazine, of course, but the anthology is Creepy and Eerie.
Yes.
And Vampirella.
History.
Yes, indeed. Metaphor. But they also had, for a brief while, they were trying to compete with Heavy Metal magazine and put out an anthology book called 1984, which featured work by heavy metal favorite Richard Corbin, whose name I couldn't remember the other day, among others. And within about a year or two, they started realizing how impending 1984 was, even with its Orwellian connotations.
Yes.
And changed the name to 1994 to buy themselves an extra decade. Which was ultimately pointless because 1984/94... went the way of the dodo and will be heard of no more.
That's true.
But also, if you have one of those shops, eclectic shops, where they got like a bunch of back issues of old magazines like that, go look around and see if you can find a 1984 or 1994. Because that was the sort of thing you would buy and you would sneak it into school in your notebook.
Right.
Because you didn't want anyone to know, you know, it was sort of contraband kind of material there.
That was when you hid in your book while you read. That was not a...
You didn't want anyone to know you'd actually managed. Because the people at the grocery store, they aren't paying attention. They're just...
But yeah, so he works for... He does some stuff, some one-offs for 2000 AD. Finally gets some recognition in, let's say, in Warrior magazine. That's where it really started for him, I think. That's when Alan Moore became Alan Moore.
I think so. You could make a strong case for that, just given everything that, you know, that was going on at the time.
Yes. Well, I mean...
And the fact that was, you know, that's where some of his best early work
He started really honing this idea that you can take a story away from the traditional, because even during that period, even during the punk rock comic book days, when everybody was sort of starting to veer from the Kirby, Stanley idea of how to tell a superhero story or a comic book based story, and you started getting your favorites, your independent, your beginnings of the independent scene, your Omaha the Cat Dancers, and your because we apparently can't do an issue now without discussing
apparently
Omaha the Cat.
That's the new Watchmen.
That's the Omaha the Cat Dancers. I think you'll find in this
Kate Worley version of Watchmen.
I think you'll find in this story arc that Watchmen is the new Watchmen.
Yeah, that's so true. But it's sort of the Watchmen of dirty books.
It's the Watchmen of dirty books. But you start. He's really starting to define what it means to turn the medium on its ear.
I think you can see a little bit of the genesis of some of this, at least with Marvel Man / Miracle Man, and later with Watchmen, because he's his new Watchmen. In a lot of the publications he was working for early in his career, because a lot of what they did were parodies of other things.
Right.
And what he did was ultimately say, you know, this is the serious side. This is like parody is to comedy what whatever you would call this is to drama. So what he did was, rather than parody, I guess you would say tribute, because Marvel Man is very much a tribute and a retelling, a reimagining of the Captain Marvel / Shazam.
Correct. It's, yes.
And what it is, you know, in the way you might like parody The Dark Knight Returns with Nat Rat, The Dark Knight Returns, or, you know, Secret Doors we talked about recently.
You know, we're not talking about the same.
But you take that idea of taking something and turning it on its ear and making it Mad Magazine, and instead taking it and turning it on its ear and making it like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies or something, where you take the existing material and retell it and give it a new spin, a new twist, but it's not a humorous twist, it's a serious twist.
Right.
And in some cases, more serious, far more deadly serious than the original source material.
I.e. Marvel Man.
Exactly.
So,
which, you know, would be a seriously effed up Captain Marvel.
So, as we get into the, because that he had a running, you know, in 2000 AD, I believe it was in 2000. No, it was in Warrior that he had Marvel Man and V for Vendetta, right? That's where they
that
started.
That is correct, yeah. That's the very first place I had encountered them without actually ever reading them.
Jefferson, are you familiar enough with the Marvel Man story and how that evolved to comment on that? Because here's my thing, is that you and I both are, and I've made no end of, you know, commentary to this with that whole Joseph Campbell school of the hero's journey and that's the way you tell a story. I don't, and one of the things is I don't feel that Alan Moore does that. I don't feel like he has that cyclical storytelling motif in his work. Are you familiar enough with the Marvel Man to speak to that?
Not with Marvel Man, but I would argue with the stories that I am familiar with.
Yes.
I would certainly argue that there is a hero, and the hero does go on a journey.
Most definitely.
And now, what the hero brings back from that journey?
If you claim
personal revelation, the rest of the world is not obligated to listen.
That's true, and we see that five different ways in Watchmen, which we're going to get to.
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, I'd say there's, you know, everybody's on their own journey in Watchmen, and they all come to a bad end.
Right. It's just everything comes to a bad end. That should have been the subtitle. Well,
ultimately, if there was, you know, I think that would be like the epitaph on Alan Moore's tombstone when he does pass, is probably everything, or something to the effect of, see, I told you everything comes to a bad end.
Right. See, I was right all along, Alan Moore. So Alan Moore, you know, we get into the Marvel Man, the V for Vendetta stuff, and he starts really coming into his own. And And he was sort of, and I, again, you know, this again is sort of an overview of his work and not so much his social commentary, but he does prove himself pretty accurately, at least to us who live now versus those who lived then, but in before times, that he was a pretty accurate fortune teller. If you look at V for Vendetta, not as like an Orwell's 1984, but almost an Orwell's 1984, you know, like, He
was definitely channeling that sort of idea of taking a good hard look at not necessarily what will come to pass, but certainly a strong and well-informed cautionary tale about what could come to pass.
So how do you feel? I'm curious about this myself. A lot of this for me is talking to two men who really understand. So... And that's why I love doing this show, is because as much as a comic book fan as I am, there's shows like this where I'm basically the guy that has the fart button, and I'm just like, that's my job. But
sort of the Gene Belcher of the crew.
Exactly. But how do you feel as
I'm just in charge of obscure references, which you obviously are trying to
you're trying to subsume Cole's role.
Yeah.
This is when we start, we see a peppering, we see a little bit in his work earlier than this, and in some cases in a big way as far as like a parody or, you know, an homage goes, but V for Vendetta really was, and Marvel Man to a lesser extent, but certainly V for Vendetta was certainly the first work, I think, where everybody kind of stood up and said, this guy's got some ideas socially. This guy's got some ideas politically that are in the forefront, that are informing his art.
Well, and it's not that there's never been a obvious debt to George Orwell,
right?
Or to Cole, you may have to bail me out. The other big dystopia with the alphas and the gammas and the betas and the
Aldous Huxley.
Yeah. Brave New World, yes.
Or for that matter, a lot of his work
is to be a gamma is to be good.
A lot of his work owes a lot to Philip K. Dick as well. Well,
and all of these influences, I think the thing that Moore does, and I don't know that I would be conversant enough with the history to argue that he does it first, but he certainly, as you say, he's certainly the most noticeable.
Right.
Is have the stones
to
say
it.
These stories are going to be comic stories. We're going to tell these, and we're going to put this kind of narrative into the graphic form.
Well, and also one of the things he does very well, and you have to understand the way American comics especially were handled, and I think what he brings to the table is something of a very British approach, perhaps. I can't speak to this at full, but it certainly seems with his body of early work, there is a much greater synergy between writer and artist. Years ago, Marvel would from time to time publish... They had a whole book on how to be a Marvel superhero artist. This big-ass hardcover thing where if you could afford that, you could probably afford to become a Marvel superhero artist. But they actually would do things like the Marvel tryout book several years ago and other campaigns. And one of the things that became obvious also in talking to some people who were actually genuinely good artists who sent away for information on, you know, submission parameters with Marvel, it became obvious early on that the idea was that the writer would write something vaguely outlining what they wanted. The artist would literally dictate everything else about it. And then literally they had to, that's why so many times it seemed like dialogue was crowbarred in.
Right.
And it's not a priority of the guy who's drawing,
Exactly, because the guy who's drawing it doesn't know what's in the mind of the artist. It would be like the director of a film or the sending a second unit director out to shoot most of the film, and I'll just cobble it all together when you get back.
Right.
I've got an idea in my head what I want, but I'll put it together after the footage is done. And that's one of the things that kind of in the background bothered me about comics before Alan Moore. Is because quite literally all of those years, the writing kind of took a back seat because what was really at work was the art dictated everything. And what's unfortunate about that is you get that kind of disconnect. That means that, you know, things don't match up like they should.
Right.
Fantastic. Some of the classic Fantastic Four issues come to mind, where the dialogue, I mean, just, see, you're using the word things, that's what brought it to mind. The dialogue can be, even though they're classic historical stories at this point, you know, the things everybody looks at and says, it started here, there's right. some stilted dialogue.
Yes, exactly. And that's for that very reason. And what you see with Moore's work is that you have this connection, this cooperation between writer-artist, a collaboration to the point where the artist is literally, you know, and I've actually seen some of Moore's scripts, and that's one of the reasons that I can speak to this, because when I first was aspiring to be a comic writer, I thought the writer wrote all the things, like, you know, every single aspect, and the artist just kind of interpreted that, and that wasn't the case. Where I was writing panel descriptions. This is what I would draw if I could draw worth a damn. And I remember giving that to this friend of ours at one point who had sent away to Marvel. And he goes, this is exactly what I thought I would be getting when they sent me a script. And what they sent him was a script of some story with like Stingray that later, I kid you not, he said later got published in Marvel Age magazine, or comic rather. They actually took this stupid story that they would send out to people that wanted to become artists, and I don't know, maybe this was somebody they were going to go ahead and give him a break, but, you know, he said it was just, there wasn't anything there, there was no substance, it was all left to the artist to try to figure out what these guys were even doing, and it was very rudimentary and poorly written, and I've seen Alan Moore's scripts, like there was a script that was actually published of, was the Clown from Spawn. He wrote a miniseries about the Clown, and I couldn't care less about the Clown, but I have to give him that some of the stuff he did with the character, given the nature of the character, was downright brilliant Alan Moore-esque stuff. But the script illustrated that he was literally telling the artist, here's the way this is going to look. Even to the point where he had like done rudimentary thumbnail sketches of the layouts and everything. And in many ways, I think that's an artist's dream, because at least they're being given some direction. And ultimately what I'm getting at is what you wind up with is what I call a very cinematic sequential storytelling. Because one of the things that bothers the daylights out of me as someone who studied filmmaking is when comics break screen direction. Yeah, and I figured you would catch on to what I'm talking about here, because if you ever watch a movie, if you know you get an over-the-shoulder shot over somebody's left shoulder, the counterpart to that is over the right shoulder of the other person. But in comics, you might have it both over the left shoulder, or in one shot, it's like an above shot, then we're down here, bird's eye view, worm's eye view, side view, up view, close. That, like, what the hell? Have you never watched any kind of sequential storytelling?
Yeah.
This is the same thing. This is like a slow-moving movie. And that's what Moore does. And we're going to get to it a little bit later and very heavily in the next issue, but something he does beautifully with the that which must always be mentioned.
Right.
I'm going to take a little anti-Voldemort.
The non-Voldemort that is Watchmen. It should be noted that, and maybe we can find a link to link back to it, but Jefferson, at some point in our storied comic book podcasting past, and I wasn't a part of this, but Rick Gutierrez and Cole Houston did a 12-issue story arc.
With Catherine as well.
With Catherine, dissecting every issue of Watchmen.
Yes, every
panel by panel.
Every single episode was an issue of Watchmen. So the first episode was the first issue of Watchmen in depth. Ad nauseum. It just nonstop.
It became a parody. It really became a parody of itself at some point. I don't think Cole realized it while it was happening, but post facto.
Yeah, well, we definitely, you know.
Is that available to listen to for like 3 hours of college credit? Or
it should be.
It should be, yes. It should be. It was a very scholarly work, especially
kind of volume,
you know,
yeah.
When I took the wheel, because that was really one of my babies in a way, because, I mean, we all loved Watchmen, but I literally, to this day, 3 or 4 or 5 times a year, I pick up the trade paperback, and I read it cover to cover.
I think everybody should. It's
as well they should. You should get college credit for that as well. But to this day, I still discover things. That shouldn't be possible.
Right.
It's been 20-something years. It shouldn't be possible.
But it's what was the title used for the original Night Owl's book?
Oh, Under the Hood?
The Mask, yes. Or Under the Hood, yeah.
Yeah.
Under the
Hood,
yeah. Read the rest of it?
Oh, I would love to. I was deeply moved by the demise of his dad's boss.
Well, you know, and I think it's okay at this point that we talk about Watchmen, because Watchmen really, for everything that came before, everything that came before Watchmen and everything that's come after Watchmen that he's done, I think that Watchmen really, and it's arguable, I will say this, it's arguable, but I really think that that Watchmen is his seminal work.
Absolutely.
Because not only did he include all of his social commentary and all of his great ideas in storytelling and all of his ability to narrate a world and all of his abilities to take pre-existing characters and then mold them into this beautiful tapestry. But
and
he also
got Dave Gibbon to draw it.
Yeah, he had probably the closest thing to Alan Moore to a best friend that Alan Moore could have.
That's right.
Which isn't very close, as it turns out.
Yes, it turns out, right.
Well, the thing is, during the production, though, they would actually go and visit each other. They were very closely related. They were mailing stuff back and forth, talking on the phone, working hand in glove, probably more so than any other writer and artist pairing. And that's why I really just wanted to go and beat Rob Liefeld senseless.
Well, that goes with that. You could stop that sentence right there.
This was the point. This was the tipping point where I was dangerously close to just seeing red, and acting on what we all wanted to do. And that's when I saw this headline that was quoting Rob Liefeld as saying, "Artists to writers, we don't want or need you." For one thing, as an artist, Rob Liefeld has no business speaking for artists in general on any topic,
right?
Especially the topic of feet.
Or anatomy in general.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Well, if I told you, just a quick aside, in the original days of Image,
yes.
I always had a feeling that there was a sort of a Mozart and Salieri thing going on between Rob Liefeld and Jim Lee.
Really?
Wow. I never thought about that, but all of a sudden I just see them both in powdered wigs.
Now, hold on. I need you to extrapolate this for me. I need you to explode this idea for me a little
Rock
bit.
Rock the Amadeus.
Yeah, exactly.
If you've seen the movie Amadeus, you know, Mozart has this prodigious talent.
Yes.
Which not only does Jim Lee have, but I would point out that unlike some artists of that time frame, Jim Lee has improved consistently.
Yes.
Over the decades.
Yeah. I agree.
Versus someone who is less talented and kind of won the lottery to get his position.
Yeah.
Not that I would resent, I don't particularly resent Rob Liefeld for winning the lottery.
No, but where the resentment comes in is, yeah, exactly. Well, the resentment certainly comes in with the sheer volume of attitude that he throws on the table.
Right. In saying you don't need right now is an artist myself, I would never say that. Not least because there are writers like Alan Moore and the people he's influenced. Yeah.
Well, yeah, when you see the absolute best in comics, and I'm not just talking some pedestrian work that sells a 500,000 copies, I'm talking about the stuff that stands the test of time, that tells a human story, even with non-human characters, that touches beyond the work itself, then you certainly have no business saying the writer has no place. Because especially when you fancy yourself some kind of writer just because you can draw kind of good.
Right, right.
And no, the two Tom are not.
McFarlane. Yeah. And I admire McFarlane's business acumen. I admire his spunk.
Yeah.
I mean, I at least admire his honesty. Because, you know, he has said that he he's really bad. Like during the Image days, during the days when he wasn't meeting deadlines, during the days when, you know, when all of that was happening, he has said that it is his fault because he can't – he needs a strict regime to work well. And once he figured that out and got out from under the thumb of of himself. Once he got out of his own head, essentially, and figured all of that out and got himself a regime, he was much better at it. Yes, I'll buy that. So that's what I admire about McFarlane. I don't admire, but you're right. You're right about the
Salieri.
Yeah,
I never thought about that. Yeah, he's just sort of this, you know, famous yet, you know, remanded, you know, someone who actually has some, I mean, he does have some talent, obviously. He's got, somehow he's speaking to enough somebodies that he's maintained a level of success over the years. But at the same time, in the shadow of someone like Jim Lee.
Pretty much.
Then, he, you know, you ultimately come off looking kind of hackish, much like Salieri, you know, who wasn't lacking in talent. He was just overshadowed by this colossus.
But then you have that, well, and you almost have a Fredo thing happening, if you want to go that route. Because, like, you know, he starts doing Rob Liefeld becomes very public. Jim Lee would do interviews with, you know, Comic Book Buyer's Guide and, you know, other trade things. But he would, for the most part, would stay within the realm of you know, comic books. Rob Liefeld went the other direction and did, what was it, Calvin Klein jeans commercial?
No,
Guess
it was
jeans,
Lee jeans
commercials.
And the thing is, the Lee jeans commercial was a testament to that time, because that was the point where, with the help of the advent of Image, if you will, you had the superstar comic. You know, suddenly comics were getting into the regular vernacular. America was suddenly aware that there's this thing called comics, and there's people who make them, and that's why you got TV shows like Bob.
Oh man, Bob, the Newhart comic book illustration TV show.
Oyster Boy. Oyster Boy.
But yeah, okay. So
that's for you fans.
So we got
that's
like
for 15, fans of Bob,
we got like 15 minutes left. Let's bring it back around.
We're up to where he's come to work in America, right?
Yeah. So I think we're at a full stop for that part of this episode. But I do want to talk about.
We do need to cover a little bit about those warrior days, because what that brought you was, you know, once Watchmen happens, then you get some backtracking where, like, you know, I spoke before on when we were talking about discovering those gems in the House of Obscurity.
Right.
You would – all of a sudden everything's – you know, it's like we were talking about, you know, everybody goes and finds the old Jackie Chan moved in for 12 seconds. And that's marketable. So everybody was scrambling, and First Comics goes and brings Marvel Man to America as Miracle Man, probably to come under the Marvel Comics radar. And Miracle Man, when it was Alan Moore, or maybe somebody had recommended it, but dear Lord, I remember being a big bursty about the birth and babies issue. And in many ways, that made it seem like, you know, not really something I'd cared about, because it seemed more like a stunt, you know, at first blush.
Right.
But the reality was, what it did was take the Captain Marvel idea, the core concept, and give it a logical means to happen. Right. It took it away from magic and made it technological, albeit alien technology. It gave you a Dr. Savannah that was no longer a comic foil. It wasn't like the cartoon version of Lex Luthor.
Right.
In the form of Emil Garganza. And did, in many ways, since we talked about, you know, we'd rather be watching Daredevil, it's more to watch. Emil Garganza's character is very humanized in the way that Kingpin's character is in the Netflix Daredevil. And that they, you know, it's you're given this sort of backstory and some history of a character, and you begin to see the world through his eyes.
Right.
And you get some amazing concepts put on the table, and you get the idea of the sacrifices. In many ways, I think that the death of Zod in Man of Steel was an attempt to meet the sensibilities of Miracle Man in entirely the wrong way. Because there is something along those lines that's much more poignant.
Yeah. Well, and again, what Alan Moore always said, and we'll get into this with Hunter, but what Alan Moore has always said about his work is it doesn't translate. Do not put it on screen.
comics, because of the longer form of a comic story,
yes,
you know, not especially a 4 or 8 or 12 issue comic story, you can earn a payoff,
yeah,
in a way that's much harder for a 2-hour movie to do.
Right. No, I agree. And
or even a 3. I mean, there aren't enough hours in the day. And even if you did it as a miniseries, or, you know, if you did something like tried to tell Watchmen in 13 episodes or 12 episodes, whatever it is with Daredevil so far, even that,
yeah,
you couldn't cover all the nuances. And there would be so many necessary running changes that you would lose so much translation that it should, and it was always called the unfilmable comic, and it should have remained so in many ways.
Well, and
because inevitably people don't get it, for one right. thing.
Well, Alan Moore was a master, and I think as we talk about this, we can start talking about other artists that were influenced by Alan Moore, because Alan Moore is a master of the comic book long game, where, and he was a master of it during a period when that didn't exist in any kind of real fashion. Where he would it regularly in any of his books, be it Constantine, be it Swamp Thing, be it V for Vendetta, you know, which was a serialized account that became what it became, be it From Hell, you know, he was a master of telling these stories, like Jefferson said, that when you invest in it, your payoff is worth so much more.
And because you want it, you have to wait for it. Charles Dickens published like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. He is a literary man that he is the reason that I say – he is one of the – I will say this. He's one of the main reasons. He's one of the major reasons. And as I continue to do this show and my theories and my thoughts evolve, it becomes more and more evident that he is the reason I say that sequential art and you know, four-color comic book stories are, in my mind, the best way, if done correctly, to tell a narrative, to inform a narrative tale to a public, because you can do that. And because then, after Alan Moore establishes that this is viable in a world where it had never been really viable before, you start getting guys like James Robinson, and you start getting Cole's second favorite long-haul payoff book like Starman. Which gone. I think is highly influenced by the
Do work. I get to say Warren Ellis?
Because you do get to say Warren Ellis. Because Warren Ellis is amazing, and his work on Iron Man was that. Iron Man, of all things.
Well, and also at his best, who am I thinking of? J. Michael Straczynski.
Yeah, at his best. At his best.
At his best. And I'm racking my brain to remember the title. But there was a title where it was...
Top 10, not top 10, I'm sorry.
Actually,
Rising
Top Ten's
Stars?
Alan Moore. I don't know.
Rising
no,
Stars.
No, it was after Rising Stars, okay. And it was about some sort of like he wrote it about something either he had experienced or someone had told him about, of like literally these people that sort of live on the edge, the peripheral edge of vision.
Okay.
And it's like this whole other world going on, and it was one of these things where one of the characters is like, oh, God, here we go again. This is much like Starman. You know, I avoided Starman for years because of that. Oh, here's another low look. It's the hip archetypal character, you know.
Right.
Because of the visuals. And there was one character in this, and my friend Steve is like, no, you got to read this. It was like Midnight something or – anyway. This one character just seemed
Midnight
like –
Midnight Nation is what it was
Midnight
called.
Midnight Nation, yes. I can't recommend it enough.
With Gary Frank, of all people. So, okay, cool.
It plays that kind of long game. And there was this one character is like, you know, why would this, you know, ethereal, mythical, mystical type of character – I sometimes overthink things, and it just – blew in the face of what the story was trying to tell, because this character looked too much like some kind of modern chick, you know, with all the trappings thereof.
Right.
And then, ultimately, you get the reveal, and it works, beautifully, and like, oh, dear Lord, you got me.
Yeah.
And suddenly, it's like, you know, when I can step away from those kind of logical prejudices and let the thing happen, this was one of those cases where the payoff was more than worth the journey.
Well, and back to Andrew's point about the strength of comics or sequential art as a narrative form.
Yes.
And prose works this way as well, but and something that I think Alan Moore is more sensitive to,
okay,
angrily sensitive to, than many, if not most writers, is that when the writer leaves something out, he leaves it out because that's where the audience comes in. That's the space that the audience fills.
Right.
So and, you know, that's an interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because that is one of the things that is irksome to me about the way a lot of modern narratives are told in television and film, especially, is that when you do encounter good writing where the audience is required to come in and play a role by thinking, you get the inevitable, well, I don't understand. What's that about? What's going on? Like, shut up. Just let it happen.
Go, not even taking it that far.
But I think a lot of stuff is just too spoon-fed. Well, yeah. And the best writing, the best narratives are those where you have to get in on the long game and well, wait for the payoff. And it's going to be there.
Go ahead, Jefferson. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was going to agree with Cole.
Well, then I take it back.
Star Wars.
Yeah,
Example.
Yes.
When I was young. And now, granted, I go watch the movies and I read the books and I check the websites and I play the game, et cetera. But when
I
was
young,
did you
used to say "live and let live"? You know you did. You know you did. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Did you just do a Duran Duran thing? I'm gonna have to make Linda listen to this if we just did a Duran Duran thing.
So go. Okay. So,
but
so
when I was young, one of the things that made Star Wars so unbearably special,
yes,
there wasn't much of it.
Right.
And that the wasn't much of it for, you know, 7, 8, 9, a little older, a little younger, that's the space you inhabit as the audience.
Absolutely.
You know, the area before Watchmen that they went back and filled in, that's the space you inhabit. The things you don't know about the parts of the book under the hood that we can't read, that's the space you inhabit as a reader. And Alan Moore is profoundly sensitive to that.
Exactly, and one of the things Under the Hood is a brilliant example. In fact, all of that material, that
the pirate ship as well. Yeah,
the supporting material that's given to you at the end of each issue does a beautiful job of giving you just that. It brings you into that world. A lot of people say, "Oh, I just skipped that." I said, "Then you skipped some of the most important things in that book, because what those things do is inform the characters. It breathes far more life. Hollis Mason becomes an even more three-dimensional character.
Right.
All of the edges are polished beautifully because you have a glimpse into where he comes from and you get some better insight into his pain at, you know, especially at that point where he's talking to Dr. Manhattan and realizes he's become obsolete.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's right there on his sign, you know, obsolete model's a specialty because he's an obsolete model.
Yeah.
And you feel that because you can read the pride in his words when he describes how he got his start. You get some insight into the soul of Dan Dreiberg through his writing about owls.
Mm-hmm.
You get some glimpses into why pirate comics were ever a thing. you get a sense of what it means to suddenly live in a world where there is a Dr. Manhattan. It's because Moore is giving you a slice of that world that he can't give you on the illustrated page.
And it's a gift. I think you talk about the people who don't read it. Well, that becomes, especially if you read it the first time when you're young, it becomes a gift to the impatient reader.
Yeah.
That's great, because now when you go back through it, you can read it.
And that's when you start finding the things.
You suddenly realize what you'd missed all those years. So it does have that sort of treat element. Of course, being a big toy collector, I absolutely adore the Watchmen toys, and I wanted them very much. And I was personally thought that it was Adrian Veidt himself was behind the fact that it took 20-something years to finally have to pay $100-something to get a set of them through Maddie Collector.
It's the long game.
I think for me, as we get closer to the end of this issue of Hey Kids Comics, you know, for me, like I was saying about Alan Moore and it being, you know, that's really where I stand on Alan Moore is that he, you know, my favorite comic authors now, my favorite people that make comics have all been influenced by the school of storytelling that Moore has introduced. Matt Fraction, like you said, Warren Ellis, absolutely Warren Ellis. James Robinson, Grant Morrison, all of these guys that exist now. Even as against and head buddy as they are, Frank Miller's finest works have been works that have been influenced by Alan Moore's storytelling abilities. And I
and
believe
also,
that to be
Kurt Busiek with Astro City.
Astro City,
I mean, it just smacks of Alan Moore type.
The best Brian Bendis stuff is the Alan Moore stuff. You know, these are things, and the question that I've answered this question quite a few times, like, who does that? You know, in comic books, who does that with Swamp Thing? Who does that with Green Lantern? Who does that with Superman? Who does that with a dystopian future book? Alan Moore does. That's why it exists.
One observation that occurs to me about Alan Moore is, though you get that sort of level of consistency, at least by and large. I mean, there are points where, at least for me, it's a little hit and miss.
Yeah.
But by and large, you're expecting a certain level of quality, a certain level of looking at, you know, comics through a prism that rather than a looking glass, rather than a magnifying glass or a lens. He's actually looking at through a prism and breaking it all down into its constituent parts.
And that story was called together. Prometheus.
And that story was called Prometheus.
Oh,
you're
right.
Absolutely
yeah,
right,
which I didn't read, but ironic that I should hit upon this. But one of the things that occurred to me is I had this sort of weird analog, like I often do, and the analog is Samuel L. Jackson.
Okay.
Because, you know, you put a wig and a costume on him. You put a wig and a costume on anybody, and they can sort of become this character. But consistently, Samuel L. Jackson is an entirely different. It could, unless you didn't know any better, it could actually be 20 different actors in those 20 different roles.
Right.
Because he brings that level of taking what you expect from him and bringing something else to the table that is decidedly Samuel L. Jackson, yet it's like this other Samuel L. Jackson you never saw.
Right, right.
And I think that's the same thing with Alan Moore. You get that consistent elements of Alan Moore, but this is an Alan Moore you've never encountered.
Well, Alan Moore, I really believe this to be true. Alan Moore is the only writer I've ever seen with the ability to homage himself. And what I mean is that Alan Moore can take an Alan Moore story and apply Alan Moore to it to make it more Alan Moore. Does, you know what I mean? Like, he could take it, like, and he does it a lot in his later works. If you know, I think that was the failing of The Killing Joke in and of itself. I'm not saying that it has a lot of faults, but the real fault of The Killing Joke was that Alan Moore took the Alan Moore idea and applied it to an Alan Moore story, and then it became The Killing Joke, which was not his strongest work. It was still a seminal Batman title. Yeah. It was still a Batman story that will live for ages and have repercussions for the rest of time. But it was not his finest work, because I think he just went full. You never go full Alan Moore. It's like they say in Tropic Thunder, don't go full Alan Moore. And I think he went full Alan Moore. And I think that was the failing.
I'm sorry. I'm actually digesting that a bit.
You really should take that in.
You see, if I were going to say that, if I were going to say had a problem with the Killing Joke, I'd say it was the ending.
well,
the ending left me a little cold, and I'd have to leave it at that.
I get that from a lot of people, because it has that kind of unbreakable ending.
Yes, it does. It has that just full stop.
Yeah, and it does sort of leave people, you know, saying, where exactly, you know, because it's so uniquely unexpected. It's not, it's like nothing you've ever encountered, because you build and you build and you build, and then you're essentially given a non-ending, in a sense, in many people's eyes. But the reality is you're given the only, at least to me, and I'm not trying to oversell this particular approach, but I think in many ways what this gives you is the only ending possible with the Joker. Because it's almost like what Dr. Manhattan says to Adrian Veidt before he recuses himself from Earth, is that nothing ever ends.
He's not just doing this because it's the Alan Moore, by the way. He does this regularly, just in casual conversation. He just brings up quotes from Watchmen just anytime.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just really, it Thanksgiving.
Anytime. Bat mitzvahs, it doesn't matter. He's available for that, and, ladies and gentlemen.
It's like Fiddler on the Roof, you know. I'm reminded of a story from... I'm not marrying your daughter. I don't have to listen to your story.
That was, by the way, 133 issues of Hey Kids Comics, first Fiddler on the Roof.
First Fiddler on the Roof. That's my first Dreptevia ever.
Well, gentlemen, did we just come to the punchline?
I think we did. That was the long sell right there.
It's all been building to me quoting The Butcher and Fiddler on the Roof.
And ladies and gentlemen, we'll be retiring Hey Kids Comics. It's been a good run, but...
About those other four
tune in
issues
next
of this
the new show.
Well, too late.
Right.
So that'll be the Watchmen cast. We're going to devote 30 issues to Watchmen.
Oh, my God. Page for page, an hour per page. So as we wind down, I'm reeling you in. I'm reeling you in. It's that time.
I
know we can do this. We have four more whole issues of this.
All right, I can see.
We have to put you in the watch. We have to put you in the Alan Moore car seat. At least you're facing forward this time and not backward. Jefferson, what are your final thoughts
otherwise,
on this?
You got
coming back to the stories he's told and the topic, which is kind of his career.
Yes,
I think I think you said it was his fanzine Embryo.
Yes,
that I think is a good metaphor, the embryo, the chrysalis, the thing that is terminally transforming into something else. Because every story he writes is, as you say, it's an Alan Moore story, and it does Alan Moore things, and we wouldn't have it any other way.
Right.
But there's a growing awareness as a writer of what he is truly doing, and I think that that's what really plays into his interest in the occult, which sounds so oogie-boogie, and it's really not, because it's a purely symbolic, metaphorical. His interest, let's say ideas.
Okay.
Or the occult nature of every idea, which leaves me looking forward to the next episode.
That's right. Cole, what do you think?
Especially after you hauled off an intellectual this up.
Damn, I know, right? Like... Jefferson, did you notice that we were just in rapt silence there for like 5 minutes? Like,
dumbstruck.
You know how hard it is to shut Cole and I up, and you just did it. Like,
yeah.
That was amazing.
You just
thank
walked
you.
In and just stopped this cold like this.
My actual degree is in that sort of thing. You know, if you want to talk about Glycon, I'll do some research and we'll go for it.
I thought you meant your degree was in stopping us talking. That is some specialization.
Get a degree in comparative literature and you'll be able to stop anyone from talking.
he just Neil deGrasse Tyson this show is what just happened, ladies and gentlemen. That's the only way I can... So, Cole, what do you think? What are your final thoughts on this as we wrap up?
I think that, you know, it almost, one of the things, of course, you know, I have to, like, pop culture it, but it's almost as if Alan Moore is like Skynet, becomes self-aware at some point.
Right.
I think that's a good metaphor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing about it is, you look at the body of his work, and I think one of the other reasons that the Samuel L. Jackson analog came to mind is that he's constantly redefining himself without... redefining himself. There's not this giant, okay, now it's time for the new version of me. It's a very organic redefinition. It's
right.
Almost like the growing, like a tree, you know, the different branches begin to spread out, dictated by all kinds of influences, be it gravity, weather, getting pissed off at DC, which is apparently runs rampant in plant life. But
that's what the green
runs rampant in Alan Moore. I get Alan Moore and the plant kingdom confused with one another. But, you know, I think that he is like the mighty oak because he is constantly changing and adapting and redefining based on a number of stimulus and a number of pressures and things in the world itself, and be it political or mystical or just, you know, he wakes up one morning from a fever dream and scrawls down a few things he doesn't really know what they are and writes a story. And that's something good writers do. I don't know what the hell I was thinking here, but it does give me this other idea.
Right, exactly. All right, so I don't
know if that was rapt silence there, or just waiting for me to finally shut up.
No, it was a different kind of rapt silence, but it was still rapt silence. So I think that that's a good place to end this. This first issue in this arc. Again, Jefferson, you've been invaluable to this. I can't even begin to describe. I really want to get that. We have a friend of the show and a friend that I've had for a very long time in my non-show life. Her name is Kelly, and Kelly Long, and I would love to get you guys together and just let you guys talk for an hour and just record it, because it would be the most amazing conversation.
This is the last time she was on the show that we just brained this thing.
That was amazing. Do you have anything that you'd like to plug, Jefferson? Anything that you're doing? Anything that's coming up? Any appearances that you're making that you want people to come to?
Well, despite what people may think from my my lucid discourse, I am actually, in the real world, I am an artist, and I do have a table at this upcoming the Texas Comic Fest in Louisville in June.
Nice.
And I will be
ironically, or not ironically, the JCU will be there with a booth.
That's right.
Yes, you'll be catty-cornered from me.
Well, there we go.
Awesome. The JCU, I will then be appearing. And is it August, Cole, or July? I don't have the date.
August 22nd. Yes, you will be in the Artist Alley at the Jedi Cole Universe Comic Toy and Collectible Swap Meet. Our first ever Artist Alley.
If you don't have enough Jawas, that's going to be the place to be.
That's the name of my new series, by the way. Not Enough Jawas. It's a sitcom... multi-camera. It's a thing I'm working on. It's in prospectus, Stone.
Yeah, too many Jawas spoils the droid.
That's too many Jawas spoils the droid.
Also appearing in That Darn Jawa.
That Darn Jawa. So you're going to be at Texas? Okay, good. Great. That's awesome. Do you have a website for your work? Because it's amazing that people can check out your art.
Yes.
It is jeffersonharrisart.wordpress.com,
and we will make sure it gets a link in the show itself. So there you go, Cole. Okay, so Cole, what do you got going up? What do we have going on? Because I can't keep track anymore.
Yeah, and I do want to point out that I think I first encountered Jefferson at one of the North Texas comic book shows, and we get talking about things because he is wearing the shirt for the Museum of Osteology in Oklahoma City.
We talked about things, yes.
And you know, in addition to comparative literature, we also got talking about comparative anatomy. And if you get a chance, do visit that museum, because it's just amazing.
It is wonderful.
As I would call it, to quote Tim the Enchanter, look at the bones! But we are coming to you, of course, from the Jedi Cole Universe, JediCole.com. You can also find Andrew and I generally on the second Saturday of every month, sometimes the third Saturday, depending on our schedules, which I believe it'll be the second Saturday, this upcoming one, on DeepElemOnAir.com on Hey Kids Comics Live, which is also the home of the Rancor Pit Live,
which
is every other Sunday. Second Saturday of the month for Hey Kids Comics. And our May 2nd episode, which will be, I think, the Saturday, the day after this airs, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so, yes.
Or the day after the next one airs, depending on how poorly I have worked out my chronology. None other than the Midnight Movie Cowboys' own Australian movie machine maniac himself, Stuart Balk, will be in these United States and will be joining us as our special guest, along with his co-host, Hunter Dusing, Mrs. Jedi Cole, myself, Andrew, and probably for a little bit via phone from California on his vacation, Rick Gutierrez, as Hey Kids Comics takes on the first appearance of the Super Geek Out and God knows when.
Oh, my God. There's not even...
We are so long overdue for a Super Geek Out!
I don't even know what I'm going to be able to do with myself with Stu actually here. It's going to be horrifying. We're just going to talk about KISS comics the entire time.
Right.
That's all we're going to do.
I don't know why we're going to call it a Super Geek Out. It's just going to be about KISS comics.
It's just going to be me. I'm going to get drunk and sing Beth in the corner. And
How is that different from any other night?
That's absolutely true. That's the truest statement.
And then my favorite KISS comic Kiss the Psycho Circus because it sounds like an admonition. Aw, Kiss the Psycho Circus.
Aw, it's sad. Just
yeah. Sure, just give it the Psycho Circus a little.
Give it a little love. Give it a little love.
Yeah, it's like kiss your aunt, would you?
have you seen, by the way, I don't know if you've seen it, but since we're on the topic, there's been an episode, it'll be long past over since then, but if you have Hulu or the internet at all, you can find it. There's a trailer for the new Scooby-Doo meets Kiss TV movie, where all of Kiss has like the magical princess transformations, like the Sailor Moon kind of magical.
Oh,
man.
Yeah. God.
And at one point, Gene Simmons licks Scooby-Doo after Scooby-Doo licks Gene Simmons. Cannot.
I think though I would see that in real life though. I have no doubt that if a Great Dane were to lick Gene Simmons, he would lick it right back.
It's a dominance thing, really. It's not, yeah, it's not a show of affection. It's a dominance thing. So I just wanted to put that out there. We'll have to remember to talk to Stu about that. We'll have to get that trailer and show it.
Yeah, so we'll definitely show that on the live show. So, we spoke earlier of a couple of the conventions coming up, Texas Comic Fest. We're very much looking forward to that. The JC will have a big presence. I'm very pleased to hear that Jefferson will be catty-corner to me there because I do very much enjoy talking to him and did not get a chance to talk to you at the last North Texas show at any considerable length anyway. If you want to find out about those conventions, including my own swap meet coming up and other conventions around the great Lone Star State, which will have play host to over 100 conventions this year. Ooh. Keep it 100, Texas. You can go to Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info. And occasionally check out myself and Mrs. Joey Cole and Rick and Andy and other crazy people like Roy and other veteran and occasional podcasters of the United States of Geekdom, unitedstatesofgeekdom.com. And
we should also state that Free Comic Book Day, Cole and I at least.
Oh, yes.
Are going to be at a galaxy called Dallas in the morning, repping for
Garland,
James
Texas.
Pickard in Garland, Texas. And then we'll be making the long haul to Hearst to appear at Collected that evening. So we're pulling
and
double
I also want to point out that at a galaxy called Dallas, the first Texas appearance in a great, great many years of Percala.
Yes.
Well, we're part of the Texas convention scene, especially in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. For many, many years, Percala brought fun and smiles and face painting and the feline superhero who always lands on her feet to the Dallas area, and it'll be great to see her again.
Absolutely, will be great. I cannot wait. So,
and if you aren't in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, do visit your local comic shops. Stu,
it's not theft, Stu. It's free comic book day.
They've got it in Australia. I checked. So,
like, do Australians celebrate it like at the other time of year because the seasons are backwards? Or
exactly, what is their free comic book day?
Wow, no, actually, their free comic day though is about 17 or 18 hours before ours.
Which is a
rip-off.
So they
actually, I think technically, Australia may get free comic book day before anyone else in the world.
But they also have to deal with giant spiders and kangaroos that punch you in the face. So it's a trade-off, really. It's a 6-1.
Iguanas and,
even the platypus is poisonous.
I know, right?
Yeah. And the bilbies and echidnas and fairy penguins. And
the Hemsworths. They're there. Nobody.
And that bloody Pollock, and I bloody hate him.
Master
all right.
Blaster.
Master Blaster's over there. They have a Fury Road, from what I understand. It's not pleasant. It's
defending them from all of these woes and ills is Jacko!
Jacko! All right, I'm pulling the plug on this episode right now. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Thank you, Jefferson, for being a light in the darkness. An intellectual
kind of rock thing.
Just star tonight. You were brilliant. Thank you. And join us on the next episode when we discuss Hop in the Pond coming over here, writing some Swamp Thang and some Batmans and some Watchmans more in depth. And all right. So next week, everybody, say goodnight, folks.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night. Good night.